This is the NPR News Update for Monday, April 22nd. News on your schedule. I'm Terry Finelli. Yet another winter storm is taking aim at a large swath of Minnesota tonight. Officials in the Fargo-Moorhead area are stepping up flood preparations as forecasters warn of possible record flooding along the Red River and its tributaries. And visitors get their first look at a new wing of St. Paul's 100-year-old Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. The National Weather Service has posted a winter storm warning from south-central to northeastern Minnesota tonight, including the Twin Cities. Lead forecaster Bill Borgoff says 6 to 10 inches of new snow is possible overnight in the metro area.
We should start to see some rain push in later this afternoon, probably around mid-afternoon. And then colder air will begin to arrive early this evening, and then basically all that rain is going to turn to snow. And we're looking for a period of heavy snow this evening and early overnight with hourly rates of 1 to 2 inches possible. So it's going to come down very hard.
Forecasters say Duluth could see 4 to 8 inches of snow overnight. The storm should end early tomorrow. High temperatures in the Twin Cities could top 60 by Friday and approach 70 by Sunday. Flood preparations move into high gear this week in Fargo-Moorhead. Construction crews and volunteers will build emergency sandbag dikes and earthen levees as the communities prepare once again for a possible record Red River flood. Dan Gunderson reports.
On Tuesday, Fargo City workers will start delivering more than 1 million sandbags to neighborhoods. Senior engineer April Walker says backyard dike construction will start later in the week.
We're going to bring out high school students on Thursday and Friday in those neighborhoods. See where we're at, get as many bags placed as we can. We'll work with the neighborhoods over the weekend to try and button it up.
As the city prepares for its fourth flood in 5 years, crews have sandbag dike construction down to a science. Walker says in 2011, high school students moved 700,000 sandbags in just a day and a half. Today, crews will start placing trap bags in a couple of Fargo neighborhoods. Trap bags are 6-foot-tall sandbags that can be filled with a loader and then connected to create a temporary flood wall. Flood preparation across the river in Moorhead is very different. Much of the city is protected by permanent earthen levees after the city purchased and removed more than 200 flood-prone homes along the river. A few dozen homes could still need sandbag protection. Moorhead has about 400,000 sandbags left over from the 2011 flood. The city council will decide later today if they want to fill more sandbags as a precaution. Fargo Mayor Dennis Wallacher says he's confident his city will be prepared for a river level of 42 feet. Wallacher says the city learned from the record 2009 flood when the Red River rose to nearly 41 feet.
And another foot above that, that's fine. If there is any uncomfortableness in the process is if that for some reason that the river went over 44. It's almost impossible to protect our community when it goes at that level.
Right now, the National Weather Service is forecasting a likely river crest in Fargo from 38 to 42 feet. Flood forecasting is complicated this year by the late spring. This will be the latest spring flood in Fargo-Moorhead history. Wallacher says the flood risk will be much clearer when the Weather Service can release a more specific river forecast.
They've got clues, but they don't seem to be. It's a puzzle right now in trying to predict until the river starts flowing where they can actually measure the flows that are coming into the Red River and measuring what's going on before they put out a crest date or a crest.
That specific river forecast should be ready by midweek. Based on that forecast, Fargo and Moorhead will decide if they need to build backup earthen levees to protect the cities if a sandbag dike fails. Much of the flood preparation should be completed by early next week. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
Democrats in the Minnesota Senate are set to release their tax proposal this week. The omnibus tax bill, due out tomorrow, will show in detail how Senate DFLers want to erase a projected $627 million budget deficit and pay for the increased spending they're proposing for education and other budget priorities. DFL Governor Mark Dayton is pushing for an income tax increase on the wealthiest 2% of Minnesotans. But Senate Tax Chair Rod Skoy of Clearbrook said the Senate income tax increase will include more people.
Well, that would be consistent with our philosophy of lowering the rate and broadening the base, having the tax fall on a little broader base than just, well, I heard 1% or 2%, and some, I don't know what the house surcharge is on, but we're looking at a little broader base and lower rate would be our goal.
Senate Democrats already released part of their proposal, which would expand the state sales tax to clothing and personal services while lowering the sales tax rate to 6%. A Minnesota man has been charged in federal court with food stamp fraud. Julie Seipel has the story.
47-year-old Chin-Sun Kim of Shakopee has been charged with one felony count of food stamp fraud. According to a search warrant affidavit, Kim waited outside homeless shelters, including the Dorothy Day Center in St. Paul, to find people with food stamp cards. He allegedly took those cards to cooperating markets and used them to get cash or store credit. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Kim's actions cost the food stamp program about $30,000. Kim's lawyer, Twin Cities Attorney Joe Friedberg, declined to comment. Federal officials say food stamp fraud is rare. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that nationally, 1% of food benefits are lost to trafficking. Julie Seipel, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Best Buy saw another surge in electronics and appliance recycling last year. Martin Moreland reports.
The retailer collected 173 million pounds of unwanted appliances and electronics. Leo Rodis is the retailer's senior director for environmental sustainability. He says in-store recycling collections have been growing at a 20% annual clip as more people become aware of Best Buy's free recycling program.
People have still lots and lots of old tube TVs, video cassette players just sitting around, and they oftentimes, many parts of the country, they don't have a good place to take them and make sure they get recycled responsibly. So we offer that service, and the more people that know about it, they take advantage of it.
Best Buy's recycling program pretty much breaks even. Best Buy stores in Minnesota collected more than 9 million pounds of unwanted electronics last year. That was more than any other state. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. The lone candidate challenging St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman's re-election bid wants to put the brakes on the mayor's signature project, a new ballpark for the St. Paul Saints. Tim Holden says the stadium will cause congestion because it will bring up to 7,000 fans downtown for games. At the same time, it eliminates more than 300 parking spaces.
There's going to be chaos. People are just going to have nowhere to park, and it's going to really negatively affect the people that are living there now. It's a tragedy. It's just not planned well.
City Public Works Department says there will be ample parking for the fans because most games happen during the evenings when demand for spaces is low. City Councilmember Dave Thune, who represents the Lower Town neighborhood, says he's working on a plan to make sure residents who live near the ballpark site still have places to put their cars. Holden, a small business owner who's never run for office before, is currently the lone candidate challenging Mayor Coleman. For most of last year's presidential candidates, the election ended on November 6th or earlier. Not for Michelle Bachmann. Last week, one of the Minnesota Republican Congresswoman's closest former political advisors said he would provide evidence the campaign made secret payments to an Iowa state senator. It's the latest of many twists in this story. Reporter Brett Neely catches us up on what's happened and what could happen next.
Andy Parrish was Bachmann's former chief of staff and managed her successful first bid for Congress. Last week, Parrish's lawyer, John Gilmore, said Parrish should provide an affidavit and evidence to the Iowa Senate Ethics Committee, one of the bodies looking into Bachmann's campaign. At issue in that case is whether or not Bachmann's campaign made $7,500 worth of under-the-table payments to Iowa State Senator Kent Sorensen in exchange for his endorsement. Sorensen denies that he received any payments. One of the many ironies in this story is that Sorensen defected to Texas Congressman Ron Paul just days before the Iowa caucus. Gilmore says Parrish is acting merely to back up a complaint made by another former Bachmann staffer, Peter Waldron, who's been the source and driver for many of these allegations.
It may sound old-fashioned or self-serving or contrived. I guess we're all jaded to some degree these days. But for Mr. Parrish, it does have to do with the truth.
Parrish was later fired by Bachmann, but Gilmore insists Parrish isn't going public with an axe to grind.
He remains a committed political supporter of the congresswoman. He considers her a personal friend.
In a statement, Bachman's lawyer, Bill McGinley, says Bachman did nothing wrong and that he's confident the investigation will exonerate her. As ugly as the allegations are, University of Northern Iowa political scientist Chris Larimer says the Iowa Senate's inquiry isn't about Bachman or her campaign. Iowa Senate ethics rules prohibit members from getting paid by political campaigns.
This is completely about State Senator Kent Sorensen, and whatever the ethics committee decides to do will just be directed at him only.
If Parrish does provide the evidence his lawyer says he has, it could also be fodder for an ongoing congressional ethics probe into the campaign's conduct. That's because campaigns are required to clearly disclose their expenses, and the payments were allegedly funneled through a company controlled by one of Bachman's consultants. The Star Tribune revealed last week that those investigators are also looking into allegations that Bachman used campaign resources to pitch her autobiography in the weeks leading up to the Iowa caucus, another possible breach of campaign finance laws. And yet another irony, that book was a flop, selling only 3,000 copies. The book tour story and Andy Parrish's decision to go public went viral well before investigators in Iowa or Washington have had a chance to draw conclusions about whether Bachman or her campaign did anything wrong. Longtime congressional scholar Norm Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute says the media response to Bachman's problems has a familiar pattern.
It can become a feeding frenzy.
Ornstein says one of the reasons that it's become a feeding frenzy is that Bachman is, in his words, a world-class publicity hound who has a knack for getting news coverage by making outrageous, sometimes outright false, statements.
If you live by the media sword, you're going to die by the media sword in most instances.
But Ornstein says one sign of how potentially dangerous this episode could be for Bachman's career is that no Republicans in Minnesota or Washington appear to be standing up to defend her.
If you don't know exactly what's happening, this is not necessarily one you want to get out in front of.
Parrish's affidavit is due by the end of the week. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
And finally, St. Paul's 100-year-old Como Park Zoo and Conservatory has just opened a new $2.8 million wing. Visitors got their first look at it this weekend. That leaves just one more phase in a project that's taken a decade to complete. Rupa Shenoy reports.
Zoos can be scenes of pure joy. 3-year-old Braden and 2-year-old Aubrey Steins press their hands and faces against a window in the primate section of Como Zoo. Inside, lanky, dark-haired monkeys fly around the room, pushing off every surface, including the window. Zoos can also be scenes of drama. 2 windows down, a 27-year-old gorilla named Schroeder stands in a corner, leaning to one side uncertainly. A few months ago, his longtime friend Togo was sent away. Then, 3 female gorillas showed up. They're on the other side of the room from Schroeder.
It was, on a scale of gorilla introductions, it was on the better side.
Zoo curator John Dee says more change is coming. 3 more new male gorillas are in standard quarantine before they're placed in Como's new gorilla forest, funded with $11 million allocated by the state legislature in 2010. The gorillas' world will roughly triple in size, with new wonders like ponds and waterfalls. Schroeder and his new family will get to the forest through a window at the top of their current home.
Oh, it's going to be fun. What gorillas will do with those features varies from animal to animal, just like people do different things. So it'll be interesting to see how they interact with their new digs.
The 3 new male gorillas will be kept separate from Schroeder and the females, because usually there's just one dominant male in a family group. Gorillas have a 55-year history at Como, but after a 400-pound gorilla named Casey scaled a wall and took a brief walk away from his exhibit in 1994, visitors complained that the gorillas and polar bears needed more room. In 2003, Como Friends, the nonprofit that supports the zoo and conservatory, laid out a plan to build what became the Polar Bear Odyssey, the Ordway Gardens, and the Gorilla Forest. The plan would dramatically modernize the zoo and conservatory that many Como staff visited as children. Jackie Stika has a picture of her as a kid at the zoo with her family. It's in her office, which was the first gorilla exhibit in 1959.
So, my grandma, that's me. That's like my grandma's cousin and my grandpa's back here someplace.
Stika, who's president of Como Friends, says Como has become a tradition passed down by generations of families, and that's what's made the 10-year expansion project a success, despite the recession, despite another nearby zoo also competing for public funds, and despite skeptical state legislators.
It's that sentimentality and those shared memories between family, like different generations in the family, that kind of sets us apart because of the longevity we have in the community.
Stika says Como is just one of four free zoos in major metropolitan areas. 7 out of 10 Como visitors come because it's free or affordable. After the economic downturn in 2009, zoo attendance increased by more than 20%, and it hasn't declined since then. In 2010, Como got 2.2 million visitors, the most for any cultural institution in Minnesota. More than three-fourths of them were people who lived outside St. Paul.
We're not going to be out next year asking our donors to make big gifts for our next campaign. But we're planning. We're thinking about what's next. And it might sound funny, but as soon as we build an exhibit, one of the first calls we often get from our big supporters is, so what is next? People want to know.
The answer? Stika says now they're working on plans for a new seal and sea lion exhibit. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Monday, April 22nd. I'm Curry Benelli. Thanks for listening.